When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What's poppin', everybody? Hello and welcome to Popcorn Culture. My name is Ben Carlin and I am your host. Here with me today is my brother Jay, who will be in every episode.
The other host, as they call me.
We're not getting into it again.
The other host. Jay Carlin here on Popcorn Culture. What's poppin', everybody?
I've already said that.
Yeah, I know. I was doing your thing.
Oh, I see. I see what's happening. You're trying to be me again.
Are you mocking me? He's trying to mock me.
This is the sound of my voice.
Oh, boy.
Actually, that's kind of perfect, leading right into our follow-up from our last episode.
No,
where
first, Benjamin, we need a corny joke.
A corny joke.
Yeah.
Indeed.
We can't skip. This is an integral part of popcorn culture.
That we've done at least 3 out of 8 times.
No, we do it every time.
Do we do it every time?
I'm pretty sure.
I'm pretty sure we don't. I'm pretty sure. Okay, did you hear the one about the mathematician who's afraid of negative numbers?
No.
He'll stop at nothing to avoid them. You get it?
Because he gets to zero, then yeah. He's like, whoa.
That's too much.
That's too much. Oh, that's a good one. Man, I hope we haven't been missing the corny jokes. You had one at the ready anyway.
I had one. I was completely ready for it. Yeah. Now, I always am. But if you don't ask me, like, I can't self-prompt myself, Jay. That's not what a good host does.
Ben, I know what good hosts do. I, too, am a host of this show.
Whatever you say. No, taking one's identity was a huge portion of our last conversation here on The Pop, where we were discussing the phenomenon of delivering a fandom or an interest or a hobby to one of your friends, and then that friend taking that hobby and taking it beyond where you had ever had it.
So by stealing identity, you don't mean like stealing someone's credit card or social security number.
I certainly do not mean that.
What we mean is you were a fan of something and you introduced it to a friend and they became such a bigger fan than you, they stole that part of your identity.
They did indeed.
Stealing the fandom. I will say that in the last episode, as we were describing this, there was part of me that was like, what if this is the most unrelatable thing ever, and we are just coming across as so petty and so selfish right now.
I too had that idea. Like it's sort of like you're not in competition with anybody. Like I want everyone to win.
Yeah.
You know, like that's sort of spitting in the face of that idea in its entirety. It's suggesting that if someone else is more of a fan of something to you, then it lessens your fandom, which of course is not true.
Which of course is not true, but we got so much feedback from people.
So
we totally hit on something here.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
For one, I want to start off by saying that one of the most fascinating things about this was to the extent that our YouTube channel, Super Carlin Brothers, was the object of this discussion. Where...
Sorry. So people were fans of us on YouTube and introduced their friends.
Most people who messaged me said that they were introduced to our channel by one of their friends. They went down the rabbit hole and watched all of the early nitty-gritty, cringy stuff from start to finish. They've watched all of our gaming content, all the things. This is not me just plugging all of our other projects, though we do have many.
Subscribe.
What happened, though, is that their friends had introduced them to us, and then they had become such fans that they were aware of The Pop before their friends were, who had originally introduced them. But the good news was, under many of the stories that people had sent in and told me, they now said that they were able to introduce the pop to their friends who had introduced them to Super Carlin Brothers, and now they're happily enjoying it together.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear.
Yes, yes.
So. We've been doing the podcast for such a short amount of time that I've had just one instance where in real life someone has come up to me where I didn't like know them as a personal friend, and they were like just like a complete like I was being introduced to someone and they're like, oh, I listened to your podcast. And I was like, what? Like, it still baffles me sometimes that anyone watches anything we do.
No, I have the same thing. Yeah. The experience of being semi internet famous. This is like the hardest thing to self-proclaim, by the way. Like
yeah.
All of our friends will always be like they will refer to us as famous like very regularly. I can never really tell if they're like kind of sort of like poking fun at like our strange and unusual job that is making content on YouTube.
Right.
But it's the type of thing where we live in small town Virginia that like we really don't experience the phenomenon that is, you know, being quote unquote famous.
Right.
Ever in the real world. I mean, occasionally the lady who owns Jimmy John's will be like, I watch your channel, by the way.
Yeah, every now and then someone will just mention that they like watch it. Certainly it's not like unsafe to walk down the street or something.
Oh yeah, no, of course. I mean? Yes, yes.
Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a weird, I don't know if it's just because of exactly where we live. I'm not constantly being reminded that some people might consider us famous. And like, I don't know. I don't know if when like certain people, like, I don't ever feel that way.
No. Yeah. It is surprising to me every time that somebody might have the kind of almost like fanning experience upon meeting us in the wild, which actually just by happenstance leads me into one of my conversation topics that I wanted to talk to you about today.
Bring it on.
Which is the idea of fangirling over anybody, or whether or not, because frequently for me when it happens, or when I'm having like a fanboy moment, I don't think I could have told you walking into the room that I would have had this reaction to meeting someone who I've known primarily through a screen.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that there would be a small list of people that I think if I met in person that I would actually fanboy over. Although I also know from personal experience that like the first time John Green was like over there, I was like, oh my God, it's John Green. He's in the room.
I'm in the same room right now.
And I don't even know if it was the proper experience, but I was very excited to like have had that, you know, come to pass and like be there.
Right.
Is there anybody that either you have had a particular fanboy experience with, or that you know that if you got to meet them that you like that your face would melt off?
Oh man. Well, I guess I have a few stories regarding fangirling or fanboying, if you will.
Okay, that's another question for you. I tend to say like fangirl as like the term in my mind.
To me, okay, ooh, I'm only just realizing this right now. To me, if it's over a person, you're fangirling. If it's over a product, you're fanboying.
Oh, weird.
Is that right? Like you're like an Apple fanboy. But you're like a Justin Bieber fangirl.
I sort of get that. Okay. It's almost like dude. You know, like I can use like dude interchangeably.
Yeah.
In the same way that I feel like I a man would fangirl over meeting like Daisy Ridley.
Sure. That sounds right. Like the girl, I think this is a weird situation where girl or boy attached to it has nothing to do with the gender. It has to do with the object or person with whom you are fanning.
Yeah.
Yes. So you can say fangirl, but it has nothing to do with being male or female. It's just an overexcited reaction to meeting a human, whereas fanboying is an overexcited reaction to a like product or show or something.
Sure, sure.
That okay, I'm just, this is how, I've never put this together in my head, but as I think about it, that is how I use those terms.
Well, so, and I was the same way. Like, you may even hear, if you're to scrub back and listen to me setting up this particular topic, I corrected myself, like, every time I went to say a fanboy moment, because my instinct, my knee-jerk reaction is to say fangirl moment.
Right.
And I was like, no, I guess because I'm a guy, it's a fanboy moment maybe, but I don't actually stand by that at all. But I also have no reason for backing anything anyway. It's just sort of the term as I know it in my head.
Right.
So I have no idea.
Okay. Well, that'll be interesting. I wonder if the little kernels use fangirl and fanboy in the same way.
Do you use both? Is it a gendered thing, or is it just like dude?
I wouldn't use them interchangeably.
Okay. So let's say our cousin Rachel, for example, mm-hmm. like gets a new Apple iPhone.
Right.
The 11 Pro Max, right. Which I just got over the weekend.
Yeah.
Does she have a fanboy moment over her excitement of opening?
Right. So yes, even if you are if our cousin Rachel loves all things Mac and she buys the new computer and has a new iPhone and gets the new laptop, then I would call her like an Apple fanboy.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. That's how it goes.
Okay, so fanboy for products, fangirl for
people. Yes.
Okay, I am so desperately wanting to hear everyone's feedback here. Also, I want to adamantly state that I would not firmly stand on anything, and if we're so ridiculously wrong for any of these assertions, just let us know, and we will correct, of course.
This is just like, I've never noticed the use of these phrases in this way in my own personal, internally, so I don't know if other people do it the same way that I do, but I think that is how I do it.
Okay.
But
okay.
In any case, let me describe to you some of my own personal fangirl moments.
Okay, lay them on me.
Okay, because I think I've gone through a lot of iterations.
Okay.
With this, and I've had perhaps some unique experiences or opportunities in this world.
Sure.
Okay, so I think the first time I ever had the opportunity to really fangirl over something, or the time that I was like, oh my God, this person is famous, was being introduced to simply anyone who was famous. Like if you have never met any celebrity before, then I think you're probably on some level going to fangirl a little just by the nature of being around someone like that.
The general recognition of the moment when you see a person from across the way and you're like, that's the person from whatever.
From the thing.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So after I graduated college, before I had like a full-time job or anything, I was working on a movie set, which was being shot here in the local Virginia area at Smith Mountain Lake.
Okay.
The movie was called Lake Effects. You're welcome to go check it out. My name appears in the credits.
Does it really?
It does. It does. Locations assistant, Jonathan
Way
Carlin.
To go, man. Yeah, congratulations.
That's right. So I'm on this movie set, and it's like a Hallmark-style movie. I think that's where it landed. I don't think it made it to theaters or anything. But that's the kind of movie it is. But they had, you know, real big name actors in it. I said the biggest name actor there was Jane Seymour.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you're there. I was there several, probably for like a week or so before shooting actually started. And a lot of what my job entailed was, you know, getting all the trailers that they would be, you know, spending time in between shots, like just parked and ready and like hooking up all of the stuff to the trailers.
Sure.
Which, super glamorous work, let me tell you.
Hey, you made it into the credits.
That's right. This is all it takes. But so I think the first, at one point, or like my personal role as part of the movie crew didn't involve dealing with the actors or actresses very much at all.
Sure.
Like, I was, like, barely above, like, a production assistant.
Okay.
If that at all. I was not being paid to be there. This is all experience-based. But it just so happened that at one point, I was the guy near the golf cart, and the way the set and, like, the trailers were set up was that the set was in this house at the bottom of the hill, and all the trailers are at the top of the hill. So anytime they need one of the actors, they have to send this golf cart up the hill to pick them up so they don't have to walk.
Right, yeah.
And they drive them down. So I'm the person near the golf cart, and they're just like, they need someone on set. They needed another take or something. The person who's supposed to be doing isn't there. So they're like, Jonathan, can you go pick up Madeline? And I was like, oh my God, what? I was like petrified nervous about this because, like, I've never been around a famous person before. This is like one of the stars of the movie. The actress's name was Madeline Zima, who I'm not sure if you're familiar with.
I'm not. I'm gonna look her up though.
Well, let me tell you, I don't think she's like a super duper huge deal, big actress or anything, but I did know of some of her work at the time. In college, maybe one of the first shows I was ever like an enormous fan of that we did like theories on and stuff was the show Heroes.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Is she in Heroes?
She is in Heroes.
No.
Yes. So me and Ben used to host these Heroes nights at his apartment in college.
Chili night.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fantastic. We'd all drive over from Tech to Radford and we'd have chili and Ben would make homemade tortilla chips.
Homemade. Oh, man.
Yeah.
The best.
Yes.
Also so easy to make.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, your apartment smelled like straight up fryer oil.
Yes, it was
all the time.
It was like a McDonald's, and I lived inside of it, and yeah. I was so absurdly nose blind to it that, like, this is one of those things where I would like show my apartment off to people,
yeah.
and I had no idea that it smelled this way until our friend Mike one day was like, "Oh my God, I hate being in your apartment. It smells so bad," and I was like, "No, like." This is like a glass shattering moment in my life where I don't know if I could have been more disappointed to have found out that something that I had been proud of, I was completely not realizing was like kind of embarrassing.
I'm sorry on your behalf.
That's okay. Anyway, Madeline Zima from
Heroes. Madeline Zima. So yeah, even within the context of the show Heroes, which is they're unfamiliar with, was a super popular show on NBC for like two seasons and then had a really slow death. Of which I was there for every minute. I was a champion of this show to the bitter end. And it got pretty bad towards the end. But I think around like season four, the big thing from Heroes was save the cheerleader, save the world, right? So the cheerleader character played by Hayden Panettiere, her character Claire goes to college and her roommate
is Madeline Zima. No way. Yeah. Okay, now that I'm seeing her, I'm completely remembering this
right.
Perfectly.
And the roommate's not a big character. She's like, she ends up, I think, being a love interest of Claire, sort of, throughout the season. But I think she ends the season dead. And she doesn't have any powers. So, yeah, not a huge deal. But me, Ultra Heroes fan, is now being tasked with driving Madeline from her trailer to the set. And I remember just having no idea how to interact with this person. And the answer to how to interact with these people is to treat them like exactly normal people, which is what they are.
Right.
But I'm just like, oh my God, this is so good. So she introduces herself to me like a completely normal person. She's like, hi, I'm Madeline. And I was like, I think my words to her were, yes, you are.
No, it wasn't.
Oh my God, that's what I said.
No, it wasn't.
I'm embarrassed to even think about it. I was like, oh, that was so lame. That was so dumb.
Jay, I have lived with you for years. We have worked together every single day for years.
Yeah.
And you have never told me this story.
Because it's so embarrassing. And so you're welcome, podcast listeners. Yeah, that was my first time like ever like fangirling was on this 30-second golf cart. Right? And of course, I'm driving the golf cart as well. So I'm like, Don't mess up driving the golf cart.
Was it like driving like when like a police officer is like driving behind you?
Yeah, it was like your legs kind of go numb and I'm just like, oh my God, this is like, oh man, I don't know what to do. And let me just say that I had a different bad experience with the golf cart prior to this.
Oh no.
Like, yes.
Why did they let you near the golf carts?
Golf carts, if you don't know, are like the easiest thing in the world to drive. But I happened to be shuttling something down from the top of the hill to the bottom of the hill. And on this particular day on set, they needed to move the camera from the house to the lake. And if you're familiar with Smith Mountain Lake, you'll know that many of the houses, even if you are not 100 feet from the lake, are also still about 4 stories above the lake.
Right, right, yes, yes.
So there's often extremely steep stairs
right.
to get from house to lake. This house, no exception, except that these people were very wealthy. And they had a golf cart path as well.
Sure. Went,
yeah.
As
so
you do.
I get down shuttling whatever I needed from the golf cart from the top of the hill to the bot, just to the house. At which point, my plan is to go back up the hill and return the golf cart.
Okay.
But whilst I'm down there, the guy holding the camera, who has the camera for the movie, which is like one camera, and it's a Red, which is like a really expensive kind of camera. I want to say it's like minimum $50,000.
How much is a Red camera? Google, go.
Yeah, go. What do you got?
It looks like options just for the base, not including a lens, are about $54,000.
Okay, so this would have been like, yeah, the whole movie's being shot on this camera. And the guy is holding it and he just plops down next to me and it's just like, can you take me to the bottom of the hill? Like, oh, you're the guy driving the golf carts and I need to get somewhere using the golf cart. Can you just take me to the bottom of the hill?
This is interesting because in this moment, you are living inside of what is overall an extraordinary situation for yourself.
Yes.
He, on the other hand, has probably been in this exact situation so many times, and you are a normal fixture of this environment.
I'm just like an intern. I'm just golf cart guy.
Right, right, right.
You know, he's like, just like,
he's probably met 1,000 golf cart guys in his life.
He's just like, I need to get to the, I'm moving the camera. Who is in the golf cart? There it is. I'm just, you know, go or whatever. So anyway, though, I have to find the little hill, which is like just nestled right next to the side of the house between some bushes and the house, literally only wide enough for the golf cart. And then I start going down the hill and it is just simply too steep for the, like for the brakes.
No, it isn't.
Like we are going down the hill and I see the turn coming and I am like, my foot is pushing the brake the whole way down and it is just not stopping. And I'm like, oh my God, I do not know what to do. And the guy is like looking at me like, dude, stop, turn. And I'm like, I do not know eventually what happened. They're like, it like forked off to the right and I just like turned the steering wheel into it. The brakes are not working. And I think as I turned the cart, the like gradient leveled off a little bit enough for the brakes to start working. And it just comes to a screeching halt. And we're only about halfway down the hill. And the guy just looks at me, gets off the cart and says, I'll walk it the rest of the way. And I was like, oh my God, that sucked.
No.
Yeah. I was just like, I am not the golf cart guy.
What a terrible, no, that's someone else failed somewhere along the lines. Like the brake shouldn't fail.
Oh, I know. I'm like, I was just like, what am I supposed to be doing? I, you know, and it shouldn't be that hard. Golf carts are so easy to drive or whatever. But yeah, so that was, anyway, that was my other experience with the golf cart. At Lake Effects.
So you crushed it.
I totally crushed it. If anyone's seen the movie Lake Effects, please let me know. Just because I don't think I've met many people who have seen the finished product.
Oh, man. It would be so funny if in the credits there was like a little star next to your name and at the bottom it was like, do not let drive golf cart ever again.
The thing is, it wasn't like this spread around or anything. It wasn't like everyone was like staring at me the rest of the time like, oh my God, that's the guy who almost crashed the camera.
Or were they?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I'm aware of.
Okay.
Thankfully. I was also not on set for the duration of the whole movie, which I think was going to take about a month to shoot. But I was only there for about 2 weeks because in that time I got hired for an actual, like a real full-time job in an office and stuff. But at that job, I was the, one of the marketing people at a concert venue.
Right.
So
kind of a unique position to be in.
Kind of a unique position to be in, if for no other reason that it allowed me access or the opportunity to meet just so many famous people.
Right. In the weirdest way imaginable. Like, I don't want to say that it was like an easy job or anything like that, but it within the building, it is like the entry level marketing position job, right? Yeah,
there were two marketing positions. There was the director and then there was me.
Right, okay, yeah. So, like, all things considered, though, you're in your, like, first job, which then all of a sudden grants you this kind of, like, backstage VIP experience access to, like, every major act that comes through. Like, if you imagine the dollar figures involved with paying for the VIP experiences to meet all of those people, like, it's a really unusually, like, high-yield job perk. If you are super into those things.
Yes, yes. That was sort of the thing. Like, all of a sudden... And so what comes through Roanoke a lot is country music.
Right.
So I got to meet many a country star. And I think it was going through this... Like, weirdly, over time, you just, like, I guess sort of adjust to it. Or maybe, like... when I met Madeline, for example. First time I've been around a famous person ever. No idea what to do. So... As I started working, though, at this venue, like, if it was someone I was, like, a true, real, huge fan of, it was kind of like, I would still maybe get those jitters. But if it was just an act coming through, it stopped being such a big deal.
You kind of got desensitized.
Yeah, you get a little desensitized to it.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. I don't know that I've interacted with so many people. There is something to be said, like, so through YouTube, we've been to VidCon and various, you know, Playlist Live. We've been to NerdCon. And with that, sort of backstage of all the events is, like, an area where everybody's sort of congregating and drinking, like, a bottle of water or coffee or, you know, having, like, a breakfast cookie or something like that.
Yeah.
The Marriott has the best breakfast cookies, by the way. Do you recall? They were really good breakfast
cookies. I do recall.
Cookies.
We did go at them, like, every day. Yeah.
Dude, actually, speaking of those, they were, like, just, like, a sugar cookie with, like, the hardened icing on top. You know what I'm talking about? Like,
yeah, they were not that fancy.
But what is so great? I don't know what it is about the hardened icing on top of these sugar cookies, but I love it.
Yeah.
It's like it, like, cracks when you bite into it.
It has a good snap.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know how to do that, which I bet is not hard. I bet that it's a pretty low-hanging fruit.
I bet it's very easy, especially because these are the kind of cookies I think they just put out in the lobby on repeat forever as, like, a welcome to the Marriott.
Yes, I think that's true. So yeah. Certainly they're cranking them out.
Yeah.
And as someone who has actually, like, successfully made okay-ish, like, macarons, I feel like I should be able to execute hardened icing.
You'd think.
And yet, I to this day, not in a way that I'm proud of.
So is your story going towards someone you fangirled over at a VidCon or a NerdCon?
Well, no. So I think sort of my general sense of it is that through my experience with YouTube, I have always felt like I am the most unusual person to have made it into the place of being a YouTuber, because I was never, like, a fan of YouTube prior to doing it with you. Like, I didn't even have a baseline for what other YouTubers did in their videos when I started. Like,
right.
It's not like I had, like, watched years and years and years of content and was like, okay, like, I kind of know, like, what the jokes are and what the editing's supposed to look like and how many images you should use or anything like that. Like, I had no idea. And so very frequently I have felt like I'm in this room where I am very actively aware of the fact that tons and tons and tons of people would be so excited to meet most of the people in the room.
Yeah.
And I have no idea who they are.
Oh, I see. You're in, like, a reverse effect.
Yes. Yeah. It's like I know that these people are all big time YouTube celebrities, and yet they do come across as completely normal people.
In some ways, I have found that because maybe that's your position, it is that much easier for you to find yourself in the middle of a conversation with other people, though.
I do think that's true, because I do think that there is something to be said for putting people, like, on a pedestal having no idea how to have a conversation with them.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can legitimately go up to them and be like, what do you do? Tell me about your channel.
Right.
Like, it's like I can start having a conversation with them. And I'm not sure that they would expect you to know what
I don't
they do.
Think they would, because and this is just maybe me seeing the world through my own lens, but I would never expect anyone to know what we did.
Exactly.
Even though we're all there for the same reason on the same platform and people have come up and said, like, oh, I like your stuff before. I'm like, no, I don't think you're right. You must be mistaking me.
Oh, right, right, right. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. So it, I think for me, it has always been helpful to not know who these people are. But then as a result, I feel like sometimes I'm almost missing out on the excitement associated, like, kind of like we were saying with your job at the Berglund Center, where you had this unusual job perk of, like, you know, meeting Carrie Underwood. And it's like, that was kind of cool.
That was one of the people I got to meet.
Yeah. Not to humble brag.
Not to, like, humble brag or anything. I don't want to, like, name drop my long list of country music stars.
But I have photos if you'd like to see them.
That was a weird thing, is that when I started working there, one of the rules I was told was, like, if you were in a picture, not to share it on social media or something.
Oh, right.
For no other reason than it might make other people on staff, like jealous or feel like they were not being treated as well. And I was told this by, like, the other marketing person, the director of marketing, when I got there, like, in the first week. And I was like, okay, whatever. That makes sense. And she did not last long as my boss.
Okay.
But I just, like, internalized this rule as, like, yeah, okay, whatever. And I remember, like, leaving, and one of their parting gifts was all these photos that, like, I had been in as, like, you know, part of, like, the meet and greet with the staff at the venue. And I was like, oh, man, I can, like, finally post all these photos I've gotten. They're like, what do you mean finally? Because, like, I had a new boss by then. And I was like, well, I guess, like, I was told we weren't supposed to post them. They were like, that's not a rule.
No, no.
I was like, what? What?
So,
what is this?
So someone who was only there for a few months after your hire literally dictated something that, like, resonated with you for so long that you were actually making decisions well after she was gone.
Oh, this was such a problem of my employment there, was that I don't want to get into it or like too much or anything, but basically I would later find out that the reason I was hired was to bridge the gap between my immediate supervisor and the next person who was going to take her job.
Okay.
Right. Like they just needed someone there while they replaced that position.
Oh, wow.
But in the meantime, this person they wanted to get rid of was training me.
Oh,
you know,
no.
What I mean? So, right. Like, you know, there was a bunch of stuff that I was told that I was just like, these are the rules. I'd never had a job before, you know? And then you get caught in these situations, like, 2 or 3 years later, where most of the stuff maybe you'd have figured out, like, okay, that was just sort of a that person thing.
Right.
But that, like, I remember being asked specifically, like, why do you do it this way? And I'd be like, because so-and-so. And it would just be like, oh.
It strikes again. You were so young and impressionable.
And
everything stuck with you. And then it's just like, none of this is useful.
None of it was useful.
I was taught the rules to the wrong game.
I was taught to, exactly. It was like someone told me how to play the game wrong when I was like, these are the rules. Anyway, I feel bad. I don't want to harp on that too much or anything.
Sure, sure.
I would say the weird thing about having gone to all these conventions with you is that even though you don't know that many people, that I feel like in some ways, when you do recognize someone, I feel like you do freak out a little more.
Do I? Who have you seen me meet that I froked over?
Froked over? I remember we walked past Joe Beretta one time
lobby. You're so right.
VidCon, yeah.
Okay, so Joe Beretta was from, he was eventually on SourceFed and now the Valley Folk.
Yeah.
But way back when, he was on a channel called Barrettes and Beretta. And this was before it ever occurred to me that it wasn't like production studios creating comedy content on the internet. This was like two dudes creating content on the internet.
Oh, that is what that was, though. Barrettes and Beretta, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, but so I remember like watching this as content that like, I wouldn't sit down and binge YouTube videos or anything like that. It was literally just like the content that the people in my life had like been like, oh my God, you have to watch this video.
Yeah.
And like sat me down. And so like I had seen and had known who that was since like high school or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like it had been so long since I had first been exposed to who Joe Beretta was. And so I remember he was walking past us on the way to the elevator and I was like... I was like, Joe Beretta. I turned around. I'm like, huge fan. Oh, so bad. So you're so right. I completely forgot about that, which is weird. because it's like a moment. Maybe my brain like blocks out the moments when I'm embarrassed so that like I don't have to go back and...
I think that's totally a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, someone else will bring it up and be like, oh, yeah.
Don't talk about that.
Yeah.
Popcorn Culture is supported by Arena Club. Okay, so you guys know that I love trading card games and that me and Ben are big time collectors of Pokemon cards. You know, it's that childhood fantasy of finally being able to use adult money to buy those highly coveted rares of our youth. And like, even in our office, we have not one, but two full display cases with some of our all time favorite rarest cards that we've pulled. But something I did not know existed when I was a kid in my youth was the grading process for trading cards or sports cards or whatever you're collecting. You know, to me it was just like a rare Charizard is a rare Charizard. Like, it doesn't matter if it's been hanging out in my pocket with my lucky paper clip. Turns out it does matter, and kind of a lot, because if you get your cards professionally graded, it can add huge value. And then not only that, but once they're graded, they will like seal them in that pristine condition inside of a plastic case, or what's known in the industry as a slab. And that's where Arena Club steps in, because it's like buying a booster pack, but it's for a pre-graded card. Now, I know that can take like maybe a second to wrap your head around, because you're opening physical cards on a digital platform, which means you open the pack online and see your pulls where they can be added to your showroom for the world to see, but you can also request them to be sent to you at any time. So they have got a ton of pre-graded cards, and then you will get to randomly open one, and then they'll keep it for you, or they can send it to you, or you can just like sell it or trade it online or whatever you want to do. But whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform you have got to check out. And right now, you can get 10% off your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/poppop, which, wow, that is a crazy offer. 10% off a $400 slab pack. That's like $40 right there. Anyway, that's arenaclub.com/poppop for 10% off your first purchase. Popcorn Culture is sponsored by Shopify. Y'all are likely aware of the fact that we have our very own Shopify store, Carlin Brothers Mercantile, and it's hard to imagine not having it now, but arriving at the decision to open our own web store was a big one. In fact, we started our journey on the interweb back in 2012 and didn't finally open up shop until 2018. And a huge part of that is just not knowing where to start, but that's where Shopify steps in. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, which is a fancy way of saying it's a really easy and effective way to start an online business, no matter if you're operating out of your garage or have like a whole building or three or something. Once we were set up, our biggest concern was trying a new product, only to discover no one was interested in it. But Shopify is powered with so many reports, more than you can even imagine. And this is so handy because it allows us to use data to better provide what folks are actually interested in. It's so easy to use, but even if you do find yourself caught in a jam, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/poppop. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/poppop now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/poppop.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
I would say, so I think for me, and I think we had two encounters like this, but the last time we went to VidCon, I found it was really fun. I felt like I didn't feel like this nearly as much. I felt like much more like part of the crowd, I guess. However, the two people there who I was like really freaking out to potentially meet were Rhett and Link.
Yeah.
Because me and Beth love Good Mythical Morning on YouTube. We watch it literally every day. And like we kept sort of seeing them around at the last VidCon.
Yes.
And the year before that, we'd like ridden an elevator with them.
Right.
And I think even you knew who Rhett and Link were.
I did.
Yeah. And so we're standing in the elevator, they walk in. I just like completely froze. And I'm like, Oh my God. This is so cool. And we didn't say anything to them. Because I think I started talking to someone else in the elevator who they knew also.
Sure.
But this year in particular, we were in the Snapchat lounge backstage, and we actually got to like talk to them for maybe like 3 or 4 minutes. And that was like one of the coolest things I felt like that happened. And Rhett complimented my shoes, and I was like, oh man, that was really cool.
Which, not for nothing, but I gave you those shoes for Christmas.
Yeah,
and you didn't give me any credit at all.
I think the way, if I remember the conversation, is that the shoes in question are these like rainbow, they're called, the brand is called Noble.
Noble.
And it's spelled like N-O-B-U-L-L.
Yes. They're so, like CrossFit or workout shoes.
They're like workout shoes.
But they're really cool looking.
Yeah, right. So I think the way I've always interpreted the title is that it's supposed to be like Noble. Like, you know, like, oh, these are like really, they'd like the shoes have high integrity. But then also it's like, there's no bull.
I think that's exactly what they're going for.
There's like no bull in the gym. We're here to work out.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, they're really cool. I get compliments on the shoes all the time. And I think he said, oh, dude, I love those shoes. And I think because you bought them, you started spouting off some of the specs. And we're like, yeah, they're knife proof.
You know, I thought that was the type of thing that Rhett and Link would find fascinating.
I think he did. But he's like, I don't know. I have no idea. I don't remember much of the conversation.
Did you black out?
Maybe. Oh, I was so excited to meet them.
It's so funny. That was one of those moments where I like, as soon as we like engaged in conversation with them, because they were definitely trying to have time with their families. And,
for sure.
I had like an immediate timer where it was like no more than 90 seconds. Yeah, it's like we need to like be like, hey, so nice to meet you guys. We always wanted to. This is really cool.
Your show is great. See ya.
Have a great day.
But they were very nice. In the short time we talked to them. So those are my fangirl moments.
Your fangirl moments.
That stick out to me in my mind.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So for me, this was going back to my early aquarium days. So basically, like in high school, my first job was at like a Petland. And then after that, when I was 18, Mom, Dad, and I actually bought like a local retail store called Ultimate Aquariums.
Right.
Which is actually still around to this day, but it was like a saltwater specialty store. And so that was like legit. You know, I used to shop there and then I went to own it and it was like, this is crazy.
were you fed going over your own retail store?
A little bit. Like when I was like standing behind the register, it was sort of like a strange badge of honor because like I had walked into there so many times and like asked advice so many times. And so it was like really cool to like be at the helm of it. But anyway, so like all through college, I'm sort of like, you know, working and like running this like little retail store. And when we graduate, I go and do this like crazy internship with like this company called Reef Aquaria Design out of Florida, who does like insane, legit aquariums.
Okay.
Like in penthouses. Like I got to work on a tank in the penthouse of Trump Tower in like Miami or something like that. And the tank was so big, they had to bring the individual pieces of glass up in the elevator and assemble the tank in the room because they couldn't get it in through a window or a balcony or any other way.
Big tank.
I've literally watched them drop like a 6,500 gallon cylinder through the roof of a building before they put the roof on because that was going to be the only way to get it in there. That was in Lexington, Kentucky. Jellyfish. But anyway, so I was really big into the aquarium scene and got to do like so many cool things with it. But the whole time, this TV show is becoming popularized called Tanked. on, I think it was on Animal Planet.
I remember that show.
Yes. And so for me, I always looked at Tanked similarly to how like maybe a like car enthusiast might look at like Pimp My Ride, where it's like right. Pimp My Ride, it's not what they're doing isn't remarkable, but like turning an old station wagon into like a skee ball game that can actually drive is like, it's fun and whimsical, but other like car people aren't going to look at that and be like, respect, you know, like like that's not the type of thing that ends up like in,
it's like good TV, not good cars.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think that that's always sort of how I view Tanked. Like they always did these like very over, you know, overly dramatic versions of how an aquarium installation might go, and oh no, this isn't gonna work, what are we gonna do? But then I remember being at my very first aquarium convention. It's so weird that all these happened at conventions.
Well, this is where you would often meet
these people, kind of people. Of course, yeah. So I remember I was like backstage because I was working the convention, helping set up for the company that I worked for. And Brenton Wade walked out, and it was like I had been the biggest jerk in the world towards the idea of the TV show Tanked. Like I would have dogged it left, right, sideways, you know, like right. I was like, that's not a legit show. That's not how you do it.
And Brenton Wade are the hosts of the show.
Brenton Wade are the hosts of the show. Okay. And so they come walking around the corner and I like jaw drop. I felt like the biggest hypocrite on the planet, because I was like, because even in the moment I was like refusing to let myself be excited about, or like even running over and like saying hello or like right. introducing myself or something, because I was like, no, I'm too cool for that. But in reality I thought it was insanely cool that they were there, and I was like yeah. So it was, I had to eat a bowl full of something.
Yeah, I don't know what the saying is. You're close to it.
Mashed cranberries.
Yes. You had to eat a bowl full of mashed cranberries, or maybe grapefruit.
Not grapefruit.
Not grapefruit.
Did you know that in Sweden, grapefruits are just called grapes?
I do know that because I read the same comment we got about it. And though, wait, I want to find the word, because the amount of times like Scandinavian words have come up on this show. What is the word for grapefruit? Because I put it in the show notes. Hold on. This comes from little Colonel Felix, and they are talking about how grapefruits in Sweden are indeed just called grapes, and they didn't understand that in English this was not the same phenomenon, so they have the reverse problem. But in fact, Swedish grapes, like what you might, what we think of as grapes, are called vindruva in singular. I'm sure I'm saying this wrong.
It's like, do you eat them on Easton von Pavia Day?
I cannot believe you remember how to say Easton von Pavia Day. Oh my gosh. Were you saying that correct? Did anyone respond?
Some people responded to my version of, was it Norwegian Valentine's Day?
I think that's what it was.
Easton
von Pavia Day.
Easton von Pavia Day, aka the name of our new Friendsgiving.
Friendsgiving on Valentine's Day.
On Valentine's Day, because what you should really do is have a holiday to celebrate your friends.
Exactly.
People said that they have heard worse. So, you know what? I'm going to call it a win.
I'm going to call it a win, but also say, no, you weren't saying it right.
I think that, well, you know what? They said they heard worse. So.
Okay, so this is something I was thinking about the other day that you just reminded me of. And I want to know if you feel like this was a real effect or not. Because in my brain, this is a real thing that happened. But I call this the dodgeball effect.
Okay.
The dodgeball effect is the result of the movie Dodgeball. You remember this movie, right? I'm sure.
Yeah, if you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Yeah. Dodgeball, I think, came out like 2006, I want to say. Maybe the summer of 2005. Starring Ben Stiller and Vince Vaughn.
Yes.
Right?
Let's see here. What year did it come out? 2004, American sports comedy film.
Okay, it makes me feel really old that I have to explain maybe what the movie Dodgeball is, but it occurs to me that it's been about 16 years. So there are like teenagers out there who maybe have never seen it, which is a huge mistake. You should totally go see Dodgeball.
Oh, we're becoming those people.
But this movie was like, it came out the same summer as the movie Anchorman, and these two movies I feel like singularly changed a lot of comedy like the future of comedy movies.
I would agree with that.
In a big way. But I feel like Dodgeball in particular invented like this genre of stuff that would be like hyper specific to an obscure thing. Like
hyper specific to an obscure thing.
Yeah. So like Tanked, for example, I feel like is a result of the Dodgeball.
Oh, interesting.
Right? Like people were like, oh, this is a thing I sort of know exists, but then it would be like celebrated in such a huge way. Like in the same way that like, oh, Dodgeball, the movie, took a sport that's largely just a gym class thing and like treated it like it was an international phenomenon.
Right.
You know,
right.
And everyone plays Dodgeball and people, there's huge leagues and it's taken super seriously on ESPN8, the Ocho, or whatever. But it was also sort of making fun of it in the same way. Like
right,
it was
right.
a huge deal, but also extremely obscure at the same time.
Obscure sports quarterly.
Obscure sports quarterly. So I feel like the effect was that obscure hobbies became like the subject of lots of TV shows or other movies. Like then you had movies like Semi-Pro, which was about like amateur basketball, or like The Ballad of Ricky Bobby, which was like NASCAR, or like there was all these like obscure sports specific movies. And I feel like it trickled down into other stuff, and stuff like Tanked became like a reality because of that movie.
So you would say that like going back to the quasi butterfly effect,
mm-hmm.
it's almost like because something like Dodgeball existed.
Yeah.
If not for Dodgeball, then the TV show Tanked never happens.
Right. Like the, like promoting an obscure hobby or sport became like a really trendy, popular thing.
Interesting.
Is what I feel like was the effect.
Okay. Do you think that there's anything to this? Because this is something that I love about hobbies, is learning that there's like this entire living, breathing ecosystem mm-hmm. of fandom around something that is always there at all times. And you have no idea how deep it goes
yeah.
until you start stepping into that world.
Mm-hmm.
Like that is sort of something that I think I have seen over and over and over again.
For
like
sure.
Like where I will have like heard of something, or like board game stores to me is like one of these things where I'm like, how on earth does that stay in business? Like there's a board game aisle at Target. Why do we need a whole store?
Right.
But then when you start digging into like people who are into board games and like the miniatures and like all the different like tabletop card games, anything you can play, it's like a vast network of people who are like deeply involved in this.
For sure.
This was something where I went to school at Radford University, which is like I say, we live in small town Virginia now, like yeah. in Roanoke. Radford is like smaller town Virginia.
Right.
Like it is an itty bitty town. And this one, I went to Radford last weekend. I was just driving around with Alice because we both went there. And one store, it may even be the only store that is still the same store as when I was in college, where I was equally as befuddled, was a board game store on Main Street. And I was like, really? That's the business that has survived since 2008, at least,
mm-hmm.
when I went to college.
Yeah.
Goodness
I'm not
gracious.
Surprised.
Yeah, I know, I know. But yeah. like, but I would have had no idea. Even then, I was baffled. I was like, in my mind, it's like there must be some other explanation that's like that is the reason why a store like this could exist, because I don't get it.
Right. Like you're so far removed from that world that you don't understand like an entire world exists in there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
And like people do things and have activities.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Like people plan their weekends and nights and evenings around doing this thing.
Right.
And it like doesn't even cross your mind as something you would ever do.
Well, other than you inviting me to do it all the time.
Well, yeah, yeah. I've become one of those people.
Yeah, you have become one of those people. I actually, for Christmas, because I'm usually so hesitant to play any and all board games with you, I literally, for Beth's Christmas gift, I gave her a board game, but more importantly, I put on top of it like a coupon for me to come and play board game night with you guys.
Yeah.
Sometime.
Is there, okay, this could be an interesting topic to explore here on The Pop. Is there a reason you think you just don't enjoy like board games or tabletop games?
Goodness, this is something that when Alice and I first started dating, she like self-described herself as like a big board game fan.
Okay.
And she is a board game fan, not in the way that you are, like where she would have really loved just playing like Scrabble or Monopoly or like, you know, any of the very, very like traditional.
Oh, no. Did
like,
I steal board games from Alice in the same way you stole Harry Potter from Alice?
Or Alice came into my world and lost everything she cared about. I have no idea why she married me. But no, I think that it, in such a big way, like we used to have all these like kind of almost like heated discussions about like how I was like kind of adamant that board games are just not something that I do. And she was just like, I just don't get it. Like, why do you not like playing them? It's like, is it because you're like competitive and you're like not good at them? And it's like, and I don't honestly know if I have like a good concrete answer other than I think that I grew up with you. And like, I think growing up, you know, it's like, oh, let's go play Monopoly in the hallway with the pink carpet. Do you remember that?
Of course.
Yeah. And that's where we play Monopoly.
Yeah.
And I think I would just get crushed my whole life. Like, right. I always lost. Like, I don't think I knew what it was like to win the game because I think for so long, it was just like anytime it ever came up, it meant like, well, I'm about to lose. And so I don't know. I think that maybe a lot of what was happening was me not understanding that other people were actively using strategy versus just making like whatever decision seemed like maybe even the funniest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, it's like, oh, you landed on Boardwalk. Are you going to buy it? It's like, no.
Ha! That was a big mistake.
Joke's on you. You thought I was going to, and now I didn't.
Ah, I deceived you.
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, I think I always wanted to be like unexpected.
Right.
So like I would make those decisions.
Right.
And I don't know that I ever learned how anybody else ever developed their strategies on how to like be good at these things.
Right.
Like, are you reading books? Do you just know? Are you like looking at the game in like a way that like I'm incapable of doing that you're like breaking down like, oh, I see what's happening here. Like you have to own, the more property you own, the more people can land on it. And then you can like tax them more often. And like,
right.
Is that the best? What is the best strategy for Monopoly? To this day, I don't know.
It's the Reds.
It's the Reds.
Yeah. Boardwalk and Park Place, I'm sure we're going to get feedback on it, are not great investments because they're really expensive and there's only two spots to land on the board. And there's like, so you have like a 1 in 20 shot of landing on it.
Okay. Because
there's 40 spots on the board. But like the, I believe the red properties and maybe the orange properties, which are the ones around the second corner. If you can get those are really good because the like cost to your return on investment is really high. Like it doesn't cost you nearly as much to get all the stuff on them as you will get it back. And if you control those like six spots in particular, then I think then you've got like 6 out of 40 or something to land on.
What? When in life did you learn this lesson?
I mean, I've played probably more games of Monopoly than you, but I think just inadvertently in my travels, I've listened to like various podcasts about Monopoly. Monopoly has a really interesting history behind it in particular that has caused a lot of stories to be told about it. In like a, because I forget what board game company owns Monopoly. It's like Milton. Is it Milton Bradley?
Milton or Bradley sounds Hasbro? Right.
Whatever company it is, basically the original point of Monopoly was to promote like to teach lessons about the dangers of monopolies and to promote like the free market and capitalism or whatever. But the inventor of the game, like in a hilarious twist of fate, had like the game like ripped off from her in a very Monopoly style way.
Oh, and no then way.
The game became about this like cutthroat business. It became about the promotion of this cutthroat business as a way to win rather than as a lesson against the thing the game is now about. So
it's literally taking a full 180.
It's taking a full 180.
Because the objective of the game is to find monopolies.
Yeah, the objective of the game is to build monopolies and then screw your opponents out of their money over a slow, long period of time. Yeah.
Well, that is absolutely fascinating. Also, Parker Bros, I think, was who had it first, and then Hasbro acquired them.
Ah, there you go.
Just for what it's worth, in case
probably because Hasbro had a monopoly on other like board game stuff and forced other people out of the market.
Might be
what I'm thinking is something along those games. And I think even anyway, that's That, I think, is something to the effect of the story of Monopoly, which is like one of the most popular and well-known board games of all time.
Isn't it also the case with Monopoly that everybody thinks the Monopoly man had
a monocle,
and he has never had a monocle?
He does not.
That's like, is that a Mandela effect?
That is a Mandela effect. Yeah, it's one of those weird things where people just remember it incorrectly. I think people confuse the Monopoly man and Mr. Peanut a lot because they're both just sort of like wealthy fat cats.
Sure. Yeah. I could see that.
Yeah.
Do they both have mustaches?
I don't think the Mr. Peanut has a mustache, but the Monopoly man certainly does.
Man, this is really blowing my mind. He does have a monocle, but no mustache.
So interestingly, going back to your, like, why you, like, you feel like I, like, when did I, like, learn to be good at games and stuff?
Yes.
So I feel like we had, like, this weird effect where, because, like, you and me and Tyler were all pretty close in age and could all play together pretty well.
Yes.
So we could do that. But I feel like two of my better friends as a young child, whilst they had siblings, they were not close in age. So they were like, they had like an only child effect upon them where they would get to spend tons of alone time doing a thing.
Okay.
And so I think as a result, they often got very good at stuff because they could just practice it forever without having to like share or compete with anyone.
Sure.
And so I would go and lose to them and I would hate it. Like this, I think this like drove my competitive spirit a lot. Like it would be so frustrating that I could never beat them because then I would come home and I have to split all my time with you and Tyler in a way that they did not have to.
How weird.
However, given the opportunity to play unlimited stuff, I would go back and destroy them. And it would like drive me like a lot to try and be victorious.
See, okay, so that's that's what it comes down to though. It's like very early on, you got to a point where you like started valuing the idea of winning because you were like amongst peers and you were losing to peers on a regular basis. And then you were like, it sort of gave you the impetus to go and find the answer to the question of how to be good at it.
Right.
And I think that, like, I, on the other hand, as your younger brother, growing up, I largely just assumed that you were better than me at everything all the time and always. Like,
sure.
It, you know, it was like at all points in time, we were close in age. We're like 21 months apart. So we were old enough to always be doing pretty much the same things. We were like on a lot of the same like soccer teams, right. Basketball teams, yeah. Like stuff like that together. But you, of course, were considerably bigger than I was.
That's the thing is I think, yeah, growing up, we were like close enough in age to do so much together. But 21 months of life between the ages of like 0 and 13 makes a vast difference in your development.
Yes.
And like size and skill of almost all things.
Right. So I think that for me, though, like going back to the board games, it was sort of this thing where not only was I never winning, I really wasn't ever expecting to win either. Mm-hmm. Like, so I generally wasn't disappointed by losing to you because I never really thought I was going to win anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for me, it was like, do you want to come play this game that you have no shot of winning? And then lose.
Right.
And it's like, no. It's like, why would I want to do that? It's never been fun. And then, so I think even now, as this board game phenomenon has become such a more prominent part of, especially your life, but then inadvertently as a part of my life, I think it also sort of ends up being the same thing, like where you're almost always introducing me to any game that I'm ever playing.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're the person who's explaining the rules to me. And once again, I think as an adult, I'm not finding myself in the position of expecting to win.
Right.
Because it's like, well, he's beaten me ever since I was a kid.
and now he already knows the rules and I've learned on the fly.
Yes.
Sure.
So, okay. Now, I think we have an opportunity here to bring our conversation full circle.
Oh, boy.
Because I think we can actually segue this. There was one point in time in our life where, again, we're continuing to do things where we're I don't even know if competing with one another is the right thing, but like as we stepped into the world of cross country,
mm-hmm.
you started running. You actually just sort of decided, I think mom describes it as like the proudest moment of her life, the day that you came home with like the cross-country flyer, where she was just like so excited that you on your own had gone and done that, because she was like a track runner.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when she was, when she was younger. So
yeah.
I think she never wanted to force it on us, but then you just sort of went out and like chose to do it.
Right.
So you started in your ninth grade year running. And then I think by the time you were, let's see here, when you were in 10th grade, I started as an eighth grader. Still at this point in my life, I'm basically once again joining a sport sort of because you did it. Like I'm sort of coming on the heels of like I've always looked back on it. I'm like, I don't know that I would have picked cross country out of the lineup, but like a lot of the people you knew and your friends, and I was friends with you anyway. So I was like, well, I want to go do the thing my big brother does. So once again, you know, we start doing this thing together. And then by the time I am going into my sophomore year and you are a senior, I think for the very first time in my life, that I am like readily aware of as a thing where we were both trying, I like beat you at something.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it was literally, and it was like a sprint to the finish.
Right.
So like to say that I beat you, we were literally like, I think I was like a human length ahead of you.
Right.
Like we sprinted to into the finish line. This is one of those things where I think we can go back to taking over someone's hobby, where all of a sudden, like maybe the thing that had started as your thing slowly like got shifted.
That is a good question. I have thought about that exact situation before, because I know that situation was always like really clouded in my mind, because the other thing that happened was that earlier that week I had like really rolled my ankle on a morning run.
Right. So we're at Appalachian State University, which is like in the mountains of Boone, North Carolina.
Yeah.
And we're like running on trails. So it's like you had definitely taken a fall like 2 days prior.
Right.
On like a 10-mile run.
Yeah. So I think like in my mind, I was like, I wasn't sure. Like I just don't know going back into that moment. Like I think in the moment I was like, you know, this weird mix of emotions of like being really happy that like obviously you had like done really well, but then also feeling a little like upset that I had lost, but then also not sure if I'd lost because I was injured, but you know, or like was I willing to admit to myself that I was just slower or something? And I don't really know. I don't know if that like built some sort of mental block that like, oh, okay, I am not the faster person or something.
Sure.
You know, like this is the way running is so mental anyway.
Oh, it is.
It's like, you know, it's very difficult, I think, to know exactly like if you didn't beat me in that race, would I have just like gone on to become like a faster person, or would you have never thought you could, or I don't know.
Oh, I know. And it's so funny because I actually have such a similar experience with this whole thing where, going into that year, so as a ninth grade runner, and the way that cross country teams work is that they're teams of seven. So you have your varsity squad, which is the 1 through 7, the JV squad, which is 8 through 14. And then because cross country is an incredibly inclusive sport, basically anyone else who wants to run is just on JV, and they just score the top seven finishers.
Right.
Realistically, they score the top five.
And the 6-7 are there for tiebreakers, which almost never comes into play.
Right. Yeah. Very, very unusual.
But you can
happen.
Push other runners back in their score, I guess, is the other half of the strategy. Whatever. Not important.
Right. Yeah. There are strategies to it. But so my ninth grade year, I was like a 15th, 16th person on this team. And then in my 10th grade year, I jumped to the 7th person on the team.
Right.
So I had this weird thing happen where I've always felt the exact same way as what you just described, where I basically jumped the JV squad entirely.
Right.
So I went from being basically back of the pack in the JV races to being back of the pack in the varsity races.
Right.
And so for me, like I never got that experience of getting to like run out front and I could have won every JV race, but instead I came in 80th in every varsity race.
Right. It's like, would you, did it like just set in your mind that like I run kind of towards the back of the race?
Exactly. Like it would be inappropriate for me to be like in a front position.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm. Weird.
I know. It is weird. Hard. It is hard. It is hard. Oh my gosh. So anyway, I don't know if that capped off our full segment here the way that I was hoping for, but I still think it's interesting to have talked about it either way.
Yeah.
For my question for everybody out there today, I want to know your experience with board games. I want to know what it has been like. Are you like good at them amongst your friends? Are you the type of person who knows if you're playing a specific game, do you seek out a strategy for that game?
Mm-hmm.
Like how often? I feel like you always have a strategy.
I do.
Yes.
I will say that there was a time in college where I had a group of friends and we played a lot of board games, and the same thing happened where I would typically win and it would drive them all bananas.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I never knew how to explain it. They would say that I was too competitive, and I even now have trouble rationalizing such an argument, because I'm like
being more
trying to win, though.
Right. Like, right? If anything, being more competitive would seem like the type of thing that would cloud your judgment, versus being a less competitive person who is simply sticking to their strategy, which I think is an interesting thing when it comes to board games, that having a strategy, period.
Yeah.
Is like putting you eons above the average person.
That is normally how it goes, I have found. So, like, I felt like their argument was, like, it's okay to want to win. It's not okay to try and win.
Oh, sure, you know?
And
sure.
It was like, of course everyone wants to win, but that's not the reason we're playing. And I'm like, yes, it is. That is the... What do you... people, anyway.
Why are we here?
I know. So, anyway, that is often, I find, the case, is that if you have even a base level medium, I'm trying the strategy at all, that will almost always oust people who are just playing.
Sure.
Like, even if you're inexperienced, if you just choose, like, it might turn out that your strategy is flimsy and real basic, and that a more experienced player would just trounce you. But often, if you can just pick up something early that you know works, that'll get you through the game pretty well.
I think you're exactly right. And I can tell you 110% that when I am playing games, I am typically not so... I don't think that I'm so focused on the game that I'm actively thinking like, oh, I see, you're supposed to be collecting the resources because the resources allow you to do the thing and the thing allows you to do the other thing. And like all of a sudden, like, it all comes together. Like,
right.
I think for me, I'm usually going on much more of a like, oh, the spotlight's on me. It's my turn to go. Yeah. Okay, let me roll those dice. Oh, a 9. Great. Yeah, I will take 3 vegetables, please. It's like,
cool. Now I've got vegetables.
Just in case. You never know when you're going to need vegetables.
Yeah.
And it could be the case. It's like, dude, if you had gotten like the 9 doubloons, then you would have had enough to crack open the chest of Istanbul Favia Day.
Yeah, right. Meanwhile, everyone else, then it's my turn and everyone's like, Ben, why'd you get vegetables? And they're like, was that bad? And it's like, yeah, everyone saw Jay get the steal vegetables card, and all he needs is 3 vegetables to win the game.
Right, know? Yeah.
It's like, oh, I didn't see that.
Right. So maybe what's really happening is that you're not only are you implementing a minimal strategy, everyone else is just dumb. And it's like, oh, of course I'm going to take advantage of people who got vegetables instead of doubloons.
Boy, what game is this we're playing? Vegetables and doubloons. It's like produce pirates.
Produce pirates. The vegetarian pirates of the high sea.
That's right. Of course, once you get into the world of board games, then you'll start having other people who are always also trying to win.
Yes.
In like a very active way. And there's certain games I'll play where you can tell like me and like we'll invite another couple over, and like me and the other husband are like really intent. And like you could just, I can like look at him and just tell like, now he's doing all the same math I am. And he's like, he knows to take these or not to take these or what he can or cannot take because of how it'll benefit me. And our wives will just be like, talking.
Right,
and just... then the game will end and all of a sudden we'll have this like entire huge conversation about all the different strategies. And they're like, oh God, you guys are trying a lot harder than us.
Do you ever find, because this happens to me sometimes where I'm like, I am aware of the fact that I can screw a fellow player over, but it's like our buddy's wife. And it's like, I can't do it to that person. Like I could be mean to you or like playfully to Allie or something like that. But I can't be mean to this person I don't know.
No, Ben, let me encourage you to be mean to that person.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Because first of all, this is a great way to get to know that person, is what I found, is that often the really like meek, quiet, way too innocent person, like the act of being aggressive towards them will like awaken their personality a lot of times, I have found.
So
like it will engage them more in the game and with you.
We gotta see what they're made of.
Exactly. Like they're good, because they're almost like, here's the thing, they're expecting to be treated that way because that's the way they're always trot.
Yes.
Yes. But you got to break that mold for them.
Was that the past tense of treated?
Yeah.
Is trot?
I don't know if that's accurate, but I think everyone knows what I'm meant.
I knew what you meant.
All right, guys. Well, I think we've talked about this for far long enough. Please let us know your experience with board games. Are you like super competitive, or are you just like there to have fun like a loser? No.
I mean, it's not like a loser. They're just going to lose.
What's the difference, Ben? What's the difference? No. There's no wrong way to play. No wrong way to play as long as you're having fun.
It's all about getting people together in the same place and having an activity to facilitate conversation.
Exactly.
Guys, thank you so much for tuning in. If you'd like to send any of your feedback about the pop, you can do so by sending it to popcornculturepod@gmail.com. You can leave a review on this podcast. You can go and find our Facebook group online, Popcorn Culture, and be sure to just keep sparking conversation. It gives us more to talk about and a better way to interact with you guys.
Yeah. Until next time.
Bye.
Pop, pop.